Welcome back to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. We are crushing it, bringing on the Beast is back, Chris Lee. He is an incredible artist who has made things like the Rhino Beetle. He has Carl coming. He's got so many good things in the works, and you can only get it by listening to this podcast. You will also hopefully have loved Decon and saw him signing Rhino Beetles and an exclusive with Unbox. Absolutely incredible. If you want more Toys on Tap, you can follow us on all socials at Toys on Tap. If you want to support the show in a free way, you can like, rate, review wherever you get podcasts. And if you want to jump on the Patreon, you can get extra episodes of the Nitty Gritty where we talk through all kinds of things specific to that artist. And this week, Chris Lee drops a good Nitty Gritty episode that you're going to want to hear about what it means to make toys but not have the audience. Now let's get to this week's episode of Toys on Tap. Pumped that you're on. I know that we've had a couple like crosses where we almost met or got to talk but didn't get to. So I'm really excited for today. But before we do anything, you got to introduce yourself, tell everyone who you are and what you do.
My name is Chris Lee. I go by The Beast is Back. And I'm an illustrator, graphic designer. I also make toys, collect toys. A little bit of everything, but mostly illustration during the day. But really, it's like 50-50 toys and client work now.
Yeah. What do you you have so many toys behind you and so much going on. What's the thing? I mean, when we say that we collect toys, mm-hmm. What's the thing that you are going for? What's the thing that like drives you for collecting?
My office is kind of like an explosion of my brain, probably like every artist's office. It's interesting. For a while, I've always collected like designer vinyl and just kind of really strange, weird things that just resonate with me. Mm-hmm. I'm collecting less action figures these days. I just feel kind of burned out by pop culture. And I'm just a lot more picky when it comes to like specifically action figures, but
yeah,
I mean, I collect everything, like, Japanese mascot figures, robot figures, like nature figurines from like various Japanese makers like Kyoto. I mean, I collect tons of stuff, maybe too much stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite things, I don't love action figures as much as I thought I would. Getting into the toy scene and doing that stuff, I find myself gravitating towards the weird. Like, I love Ninja Turtle bootlegs. Like, that my favorite thing. I have a weird one sitting next to me. Like, it's my first stuffed animal that I have. And that seems weird, but it's such a crazy looking bootleg. Or like,
it's a bootleg turtle stuffed animal.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yep. That's what it is.
Yeah, so nice. For sure. And that company probably would deny. So doing that and like any action figures I have, it's like either their nostalgia purposes because they're from when I was a kid or people send them to me. But yeah, I definitely get the like, you got to collect the weird, you got to collect the things that like Japanese mascots, like that's a cool thing to collect.
Yeah. It's I mean, there's so many of them. I mean, you have some of your core ones that people know, like the orange elephant, Sato-chan, and like Pekko-chan, the girl with like, you know, from the candy brand where she's like licking the side of her mouth. But I mean, there's so many strange ones from like just banks, like Japanese banks that would just produce their own little characters. But yeah, I don't really pick, you know, I don't collect one. I just collect whatever I think is cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's all over the place. I feel like talking about my collection would be its own video.
That's crazy. I have friends that have come back from Japan and they were talking about the fact that everyone has a mascot. And then you come to the US and like no one really does that. If they have a logo, it doesn't get made into a toy.
No. We need that character culture here, but I don't think it'll ever catch on the same way.
Yeah.
So
maybe yeah. Bucky's unfortunate. Will be the trend.
Oh yeah. maybe not Bucky's, but yeah.
Yeah.
But I guess that idea, you know, it's like,
it's so crazy to think that any like a candy store has a toy, but also a bank could produce figures or like, mm-hmm. like that stuff is so weird. But when you like all of the stuff that you do kind of stems from where you grew up, what you loved growing up, those toys, cartoons, all that. Tell me about your childhood. Tell me about all the things you grew up playing with and all that.
Mm. Well, like a lot of your guests, I'm born in 82.
Yeah.
So I was at the tail end of Star Wars, but like knee deep in Ninja Turtles.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, Return of the Jedi, I consider my Star Wars movie. And I know people hate that movie, but that was like my movie because it came out in what, 83. So by the time I was able to watch it, like, you know, that was the one I saw the most. And I think I love that just because there were so many creatures and just weird, you know, monsters and all that stuff. But I mean, I watched all of them, but mm-hmm. So Star Wars, Star Wars, He-Man, Ninja Turtles, like the Holy Trinity.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of weird things I like too, or like kind of like lesser known brand, like properties like Rock Lords.
Okay.
It's like those rocks that kind of were Transformers.
Yeah.
And I was really into Constructs. Do you remember that brand, Constructs?
I've never heard of Constructs.
It kind of had a resurgence, you know, now. Mm-hmm. Like they released some He-Man and some other licensed ones, but they had this, it was a building system,
mm-hmm.
but the building system was really unique. It had these, I don't know, kind of like hubs, these square hubs that you could connect. And they had some really amazing space sets. You should look it up later. It's awesome. But I feel like sessions with Constructs really shaped my early childhood.
Yeah. Was that like a competitor of Lego at the time?
No, they're not even like Lego bricks, or they're not bricks at all. They're it's like a building system. It's really hard to describe.
Okay.
But if you look up like vintage Constructs, it'll pop up.
Okay.
It's pretty awesome. Yeah.
Now you're going to open something else up and I might get rid of everything behind me.
No.
That's crazy. Yeah. Is it kind of like the thing that comes to mind is in, you know, the movie, The Sandlot, when he's building with all those like,
it's oh like yeah, I think that's
metal
like a
contraption.
Yeah, that was like an Erector set.
Okay.
That's like 60s, but it's the same idea. It's kind of like the 80s version of that.
Yeah.
But plastic.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then going, I mean, you grew up in like the best of the toys, right? So
yeah.
You get everything that's cool, you get all the major brands, all the cool stuff. As you get older, do toys kind of just like get ripped from you? Do they get sold off by your parents? Do you just forget about them?
So I have a unique story there. My mom, in the early 90s, she worked mm-hmm. at Toys R Us for 10 years.
Holy cheese.
Yeah. So it was, toys never left my peripheral. If anything, I don't know, her time there, her decade working there kind of burned toys into my being, my identity. I have so many crazy memories, like when like Marvel figures or X-Men figures would come in, she'd take me to the back and we'd open up a case and like, you know, grab the one I want. I mean, you know, case fresh wasn't a thing. Obviously it was more of like I had that access. And back then there were no, like there weren't crazy collectors like today. Like
mm-hmm.
it was just more of like, my mom just wanted to help me out. So
that
was pretty cool.
Your mom was the first case breaker and like,
yeah, she was, you know, honestly, maybe she wasn't allowed to do that back then, but you know, no one was keeping tabs there. You know, there were so many toys filling the pegs in the early 90s. Like it didn't matter.
Yeah. Yeah. That is, man, to be, and to not even know how cool that is as a kid is tough. Cause now it's like, I dream about someone being like, hey, come with me. We're going to open a case and you're going to get whatever one you want.
Yeah.
That is cool. That is a cool experience. And so since it never left, did you just get to keep all your childhood toys? Did you just, like storm away until now?
Yeah. Okay. I did make a mistake in sixth grade because I didn't have any money, and like $30 was $1 million to me. And yep. I sold half of my Ninja Turtle collection to my sixth grade classmate without telling my parents. And my mom was pissed. And so that I regret. I was like, why did I do that? Because I would have totally enjoyed those, you know, today. And so there's that. But my mom, you know, my parents kept most of my stuff. It was kind of one of those things, like when I moved out, they're like, hey, you're going to take this with you, you know? So I know a lot of people don't have that option, you know, like they get rid of their stuff early. But yeah, I think, you know, in high school, it became, because my mom still worked there when I was, even early high school, because Spawn was popular.
Mm.
And so I was starting to collect that. And then Power of the Force, like in 95.
Yeah.
Meet Chum, the adorably deadly hammerhead shark creation from Pocket Salsa and Toys on Tap that has come from the depths to join your toy shelf.
Shark! Take it out of the water! Shark!
He can be found in the wild later this year in several different blank colors, and in some cases, rarer painted versions of Chum can be found. This chubby little guy comes in at 4 inches tall with 1 point of articulation.
You're gonna need a bigger boat.
He is the perfect mix of cute and deadly.
I am never going back in the water.
Don't miss out on your chance to capture one of these little guys before they're gone.
95, 96, when Star Wars came back like with a vengeance.
Yeah, not great vengeance, though.
No, I know. But you know what? At the time, it's all we had.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like people were truly collecting them back then.
Yeah.
So I think it was just in phases, you know, like started with my kids' toys, then, you know, started collecting whatever my teenage self enjoyed. And then,
Power of the Force, that was what I grew up with.
Yeah.
So I knew no better than those toys. And then as you get older.
Than Buff Luke. Yeah.
Yeah. And then you get older and you look back and you're like, wait, there was better toys. I just didn't get to them.
But not Star Wars, not easily accessible or affordable.
Right.
Like we went from like Star Wars Bendems to Power of the Force. It was like a huge jump.
Yeah.
You know, like all we had were those bendy figures, and it was crazy. It was like a desert.
Yeah.
You know, so.
That is crazy. Toys has had to have informed your art, because at some point art picks up, because now your entire life is art.
Yeah.
And so high school, when you still like your mom is still at Toys R Us, we're still on the periphery of toys. When does art kind of creep in and take hold?
Art has always been just part of me.
Yeah.
My parents always kind of nurtured that from the beginning. So, you know, I don't think any kid, you know, I count kid as even high school, really takes art seriously.
Yeah.
You know, we all have goals, dreams, but I think, you know, so art, you know, huge part of my life all throughout childhood, growing up. So I don't know if, you know, there was a point where it took hold, but I think when I decided to go to school for graphic design and kind of niche down and say, like, this is what I want to focus on, because I was really into advertising.
Yeah.
Like that industry back then, I was like, oh, I want to do print ads and like, you know, work at Wieden and Kennedy and do stuff for Nike, like things like that, like kind of like late 90s style advertising.
Yeah.
You know, that's when I was like, okay, this is kind of what I want to do. But illustration was never a focus then. You know, I think illustration back then, when you think about it as like a college major, it's like, it could be more traditional art or illustration, or like editorial illustration. I mean, it's such a broad topic. So just my school that I went to, Sacramento State, had a really good graphic design program. And so I decided to just pursue that. And then as I was going through that, I ended up melding my, you know, my love for drawing with graphic design, and it just kind of started mixing together in a pot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, graphic design it's always interesting. Like a friend of mine, as we were growing up, I didn't know it, but he on the side was doing graphic design stuff through high school and is now a tattoo artist and has an eye for art and all kinds of stuff. And it was like, why didn't you ever tell me that this was a thing? Like going through, we could have both been doing that.
Graphic design really trains your eye to see things in, I guess, more structured ways.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like you see an illustrator who's an exceptional artist, like draftsperson or colorist or whatever. And, you know, you ask them to lay out their own book and it's like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, this typography.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it really matters, you know? And I feel like, I'm thankful for that background and that discipline because it really informs like how I approach my illustration work. So,
Yeah. And then, I mean, you go to school for this, you graduate. Tell me about that first job, coming into some kind of art, anything.
Oh, my first real art job actually was when I was 18. I joined, there was an organization that's, I don't think it's around anymore, but they had one in a lot of major cities. It was called ADAC and it was the Art Directors and Artists Club. That's what the acronym was for. And I joined a meeting one day because the local design firm was talking, and I was, you know, I was just trying to get immersed in this career path I chose. So I'm in community college. I joined this, I would go to this ADAC meeting and I bring my digital portfolio, which is printed out from Kinko's.
Yeah.
And it's basically a bunch of my high school Photoshop projects, a lot of Photoshop collages and like coloring my artwork and like nothing major. I mean, nothing of substance to a design firm who's doing like logo and branding work. But I approached them and I said, hey, I brought my portfolio. Can I show you? And I'm just curious, do you have any internships available? And they gave me one.
Oh, great.
And so at this time I'm in community college taking like beginning Illustrator classes, beginning Adobe InDesign. And I get this internship and I end up staying at that job throughout college. So as I'm learning actual graphic design skills and applying them to my now job, it's like, so I always had kind of real world experience as I was going through school.
Yeah.
You know, that also comes with its own frustrations and, you know, I let some clients down, but it's, you know, part of being young and inexperienced, but they really gave me a chance. And I'm so thankful for that back then.
Yeah. Those clients that we let down along the way, like, thank you for being those clients that we got to learn from.
Totally. Yeah. I remember crying because like, I ended up like my boss gave me a job to manage myself. This was like, you know, my senior year of college. So, and, I dropped the ball on some changes and it ended up eating up the budget, and she didn't get mad at me. It was more a learning experience, but it was a job that I would have earned the entire amount for versus the firm.
Yeah.
And it wasn't much. I think it was like $1,000 back then. And, but, you know, I messed up. And so, yeah, I'm definitely thankful for those moments.
Yeah. Now now we learn and we're like, we're not burning through $1,000 anymore, but
no.
Yeah. And then like sticking with that through college, what does that look like to leave that place with the skill sets and all the degree and everything, going and searching out, like, I guess the next art job or the next thing that would have driven you?
So during college is probably the time I kind of discovered this kind of illustration, graphic design, character design, hybrid thing I wanted to make. And so 2004, I came across an issue of there's this magazine called Vapors. It was like a skate and street culture magazine from Sacramento. And funny story, I ended up working for this magazine later, but I'm out of Borders in 2004 reading this magazine. that had a feature on this UK artist named Pete Fowler.
Mm-hmm.
And his illustration style and just character design work and everything just kind of opened my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I want to do this. So sometimes you just come across that piece of media or that piece of inspiration that just like flips a switch.
Yeah.
And yeah. That was it for me, was that magazine and that artist. And, you know, 04, I discovered, actually was it 04? Maybe that same year I discovered Kid Robot.
Mm. And, which that's early on to discover.
Yeah.
Designer maybe, toys. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe 2003. Like Kid Robot was a completely different company back then.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they had was all imports. I mean, I guess everything's technically imports, but like all these Hong Kong artists, a lot of like trailblazers, like Michael Lau and Jason Su and all these people. And my cousin for Christmas one year bought all the cousins like, hey, I went to this store called Kid Robot and bought you guys all these little cute blind box toys. Or they weren't even called blind box. These cute little toys, mm-hmm. which were blind boxes. But they happened to be from that artist, Pete Fowler. And it was his Monsterism series. And then I got that and I saw it and I just connected it to his work. And then I was just like, I've never seen anything like this before. I mean, for you, I'm sure, you know, it sounds like your story too. It's like, you're just introduced to this, like through like Sucklord, right? And it was like, what is this world?
Yeah. And I think like, I do envy those that got introduced to it through something like Kid Robot. Cause that's like the, in comparison, the higher end professional side of production and all those things. And I missed out on so much of that looking and then like being introduced through Sucklord and like, what are we doing making toys? Like, this is crazy.
Yeah. I guess I'm speaking more to that joy of discovery.
Yeah.
It's like you didn't know something was there and then it's just presented to you like full force. So
yeah.
And vintage Kid Robot, there's nothing that can compare to those days. Like, you know, you ask anyone who was into that scene back then on that message board, even pre-message board where it was just kind of an underground store. It's just like, I mean, Huck, when I was frequenting that San Francisco store, Huck was the manager. Huck G was the manager of that store. So
Empire Blister. Empire Blisters. Specializing in action figure blisters. 3.75 inch or 1/18 scale. 19 different styles. Two sizes of clamshell figure cases. Four different bulk pack options. Quantities of 100 sample packs available. Empire Blisters.
Now sponsoring Toys on Tap.
That means a 10% off coupon on checkout. Use code Toys on Tap 10. That's TOYSOMTAP 10.
Empire Blisters. Empire Blisters.
It's a long time ago. He was just a retail employee.
Yeah, which is crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
After you connect the toy to the art that you saw, how does that kind of change you? Because seeing art in graffiti or painting or something, and then seeing it in a figure is crazy. Because then you do, like, toys are now art to you.
Yeah.
And what does that do to you?
One, I mean, I have no idea how manufacturing works at this stage, like zero clue. It's all magic. I mean, it's still magic now.
Yeah.
But I had no idea of the manufacturing process. It was more about like characters that can become toys, but it's more about designing a cool cast of characters. And at the time, like, I feel like, the culture really, I mean, people love characters now, but those kinds of characters were more prevalent in design work. And there's an illustration conference called Pictoplasma that still happens now, but that's like all character based, like it's just celebrating character design, which is amazing. So I was like, I want to create my own characters like how Pete Fowler did, you know, but in my own style, my own voice. You know, at this time in college, I'm trying to discover what that is still. And I created this cast of characters called, it's called the Urbanites.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was just, I mean, it's easier for you can look it up and then, or we can provide some links later.
Yeah.
But I made these characters, and then I was heavily on MySpace back in the day because that's what everyone was doing. Mm-hmm. And I was connecting with a lot of you know, artists who then became bigger names like Joe Ledbetter. Mm-hmm. And he invited me to a show in Hollywood, you know, because I'd post my art on MySpace and have my website. He said, "Hey, I'm putting together a group show. Do you want to be a part of it?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's like LA, you know, I'm from Sacramento. Like I'll do an art show."
Yeah.
And so, you know, I did some pieces revolving around these urbanite characters. And at that show, there were some people who worked at Kid Robot that were like really well known on the message boards and just management in the company. And there's another toy producer there at the time. They're no longer in business. They're called Weedy Wheat Studios. And he approached me. He's like, "Hey, I love these. Like, let's do something, you know?" And so 24-year-old me was like, "Oh my gosh, this is exactly what I wanted." So this is around 2005, maybe at, like early 2005. Mm-hmm. So maybe a year and a half after I discovered like this world. And, you know, went into it with being a little naive, mm-hmm. but also like willing to take any opportunity someone was giving me.
Yeah. That's crazy. A year into seeing the toys and someone says, "Let's do this." And
well, yeah, based on, you know, and I'm just showing it like showing these characters at like coffee shops in Sacramento.
Yeah.
And like my friend had a store, like really like I'm just trying to do whatever I can to like, you know, get my name out, get my work out. And you just have that enthusiasm when you're younger.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's no social media. There's nowhere I could like just throw it up and have people reshare it. So it's hard when younger artists ask me today, like, you know, what can I do? It's like, it's really hard because my experience is so different.
Yeah.
You know, in many ways, it's a lot harder now to mm-hmm. be seen.
Yeah.
And our attention span is just like shot.
Yeah. So is crazy hard to be seen. And especially mm-hmm. like you're going to Designer Con. So this weekend you'll see, I mean, anyone that goes sees what, 700 artists in one room that mm-hmm. are just producing. And you, in order to get seen, to have stuff, have to either have something that's better than all of them or have a connection to someone or just get really lucky.
And the hard part is there's very few companies who are willing to like come across an artist and say like, "Hey, let's produce. I love your design. Mm-hmm. Let's make it. Like, I want to invest in you."
Yeah.
And the early 2000s, there were so many companies that were, I mean, they're not around anymore, but there were just more opportunities for artists to kind of catch a break like that. Like if your goal was to make a toy, but you couldn't afford it, you know, there was no Kickstarter. You don't have to do any of that. It was just kind of like these companies could fund it for you.
Yeah.
You know, just like how that Weedy Wheat Studios came to me. They only produced two of the toys of, you know, a proposed line. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I was still grateful that even those got made back then. So,
yeah, I mean, and it's tough too, like early social media and early stuff, like having that produce and then trying to promote that toy. Mm-hmm. Is probably the hardest thing in the world.
Oh yeah. Well, I remember the first time we promoted the figure. The figure's name was Mello. It was kind of mm-hmm. the mascot of the Urbanites. Who's kind of?
Do you have one, by the way?
I do. It's in the garage. I should have brought it right here so I could show it to you.
Oh, that's okay. That's okay.
Yeah. We can post the link or something later. So the earliest promotion was at Comic-Con in 2005, and Comic-Con in 2005 was completely different than it is 20 years from now. And like, there's a whole section of designer vinyl, and it was just like, just the energy was there. It was a new thing and people were doing crazy stuff. It was just showing prototypes there. So it was a lot of in person, you know, mm-hmm. handing out postcards, things like that.
Yeah.
I still believe in that method. I feel like that's still very important to, you know, kind of show up. Because things you see on the screen it's different than seeing it in person. So.
Yeah, it seems like that's become more commercialized, Comic-Con. And I think
that's an understatement. Yeah.
Yeah. A friend of mine has an axe throwing shop down there, and every time Comic-Con comes in, they rent out her shop and turn it into any number of whatever properties that they do.
Yeah.
And it's like, I have no connection to anything. Like, yeah, it's cool, but I don't care if there's a, like, it doesn't feel like there's an artist behind it. It just feels so out there. And so Designer Con, everyone pushing and everyone doing that, I think that's the dream of the eventual dream of Toys on Tap, of like, how do I just walk through Designer Con and say, your work is great. Let's find a factory. Let's do this.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like Last Bastion is kind of offering that service. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not funding projects, but they're kind of shepherding people through the process.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, I mean, there's still a lot of gatekeeping, I feel, in the community, mm-hmm. just like resources and stuff, but we're all making different things. And it's just about helping someone, just pointing someone in the right direction to get something made.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Just, I fully believe in just like, you know, if you're ready to make a toy, like your work is ready and you have the audience, like I'll help you. Like, you know,
the audience just, is the toughest part.
Oh no. Yeah, it is.
That's
always my number one. You know, when someone's like, oh my gosh, can you tell me where, you know, a factory recommendation? And then, you know, I check out their work and then talk to them like, you know, let's step back a little bit.
Yeah. Like, let's see if you can sell 200 of anything.
Of anything. Or have you even shown this? You're just jumping straight into production. And it's like, there's a lot of things people don't think about. And I'm like, I don't want you to waste, you know, $10,000.
Yeah.
Just want the vinyl medium, you know?
Yeah.
It's not the medium. It's like the design. It's, do people resonate with your design?
Yeah.
Have people even seen it? You know, there's also that.
Yeah. I think that's the thing that I like, I'm learning so much of, even in this small, like that chum piece. It's like, mm-hmm. it didn't cost me tens of thousands. So like, I'm luckily not into it with that much, but the bigger part is like, this is a good test. Do I have the audience? Do I have this to make this a viable option for Toys on Tap?
Did you show Chum before and like as a 3D print, as a painted prototype?
Yeah.
Oh, you did?
We like, the only thing we didn't do was a painted prototype. But there was like possible paint mock-ups of stuff. And so it was So, blanks.
So you're getting people excited about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that's the, you know, I mean, that got birthed out of a gallery produced a toy of mine and then was mad at me that it didn't sell well, but they posted it one time and like hid it behind another post. And it was like, man, your guys' following is massive and you didn't promote or do anything and you're mad. Like, it's shocking that I have to tell you how to run social media.
Yeah.
And so
are you talking about the Furby one?
Yeah.
The Furb Zerker.
Right? Yeah, that guy right there.
That's a really great sculpt. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, the sculptor that did it, I still work with him on stuff and he is, he crushes it. We're working on something that's like crazy right now and I'm excited for that project as well.
Yeah. No, it is difficult when you have to rely on other people to do certain things, mm-hmm. but it happens sometimes.
So. Yeah, it was a good learning lesson. And I think that's so coming off of the high of getting figures produced or like even the conversation, 24 years old, you're like moving in this direction now. Like this, I can only imagine the next conversation to someone is like, I'm a professional artist, like, hi. And so like, what does that look like? How does that kind of change your trajectory?
I think it's more of a, I haven't really thought about these feelings and 20 years.
Yeah.
I think it's, it doesn't necessarily change it. It kind of cements it. I feel like it's something I set out to do. I found a way to do it. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to try to keep doing it.
Yeah.
You know, all the while nurturing this kind of graphic design, interest and work and like trying to figure out my style, which I feel like is still always evolving, but I feel like in your early art, like professional art exploration is when you're really trying to figure out what that is. And it takes time. Like it's taken me, 15, 20 years to feel comfortable with what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my work now doesn't look like anything I did back in 2005. But it put me on that path, and just my work from that starting point just keeps evolving. Like, my character work now is obviously comes from, you know, that work back then.
Yeah.
So, you know, had these toys made. I had a solo art show at Kid Robot, that same Kid Robot I went to all the time in San Francisco in late 2005. And
that's, you know, so that was always quick.
I know, that was always a dream of mine too. I was like, I want an art show here, because they would host art shows every month.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was my favorite store. I was like, I want to see my art here someday. So that happened. And then I moved to LA to actually work for Weedy Wheat Studios, mm-hmm. just as like helping with design stuff. And that kind of went south, but, you know, and just business was just kind of all over the place. So I had to find a new job,
mm-hmm.
And I ended up going on Craigslist and finding a job listing for that Vapors magazine, that one I told you about with Pete Fowler.
Yeah.
And I applied, I took a design test, and I got hired, and I ended up being the art director for that magazine, which was like a weird full circle thing. Cause it started in Sacramento, got bought by a media company in LA. They were running it. And so now I'm working at Vapors, and, yeah, that was an experience.
Mm-hmm.
Cause an art director there meant one person designs the whole magazine.
Oh, that is not cool. An art director.
No, it's not at all. but it was cool because, like, I got to go on a lot of photo shoots and like meet, like, you know, kind of like B tier celebrities and like musicians, yeah. and like skateboard legends, and it was pretty cool.
Is this, you know, like,
especially being young,
adjacent to something like Thrasher magazine?
No, this was more like skate and street culture, where Thrasher is like
just skate.
I feel like
crazy.
Underground skate. Yeah.
Okay. So art director, doing mm-hmm. all this, like going all the shoots and everything, does that mean your art kind of gets left behind? Because the second we have a creative job, like, our creative juices get limited, right?
That's the thing. While this is happening simultaneously, I basically never stopped kind of pursuing freelance.
Okay.
Like, at this time, design blogs on the internet were huge. Like, that's how you found out about what artists are doing, because they would have these like news feeds, mm-hmm. these sidebars that have like links to like, hey, check this out, look at what this person's doing. And at the time, like, one of my other goals was to get on the news feed of this website called Design is Kinky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still around today, but back then that was like a hub. That was like, you go there for all the cool like design stuff. And so I was like, one day my art's going to get posted there. And it did. And I was like, oh crap. And then, you know, that, I don't know what that brought, but for me, it was kind of like just one of those goals. But, you know, 06 and stuff, I was doing like illustrations for Honda ATV and like a bunch of commercial clients. Cause mm-hmm. just through my work spreading, through these blogs at the time, I did some like editorial illustration for Xbox magazine, when Xbox came out.
Yeah.
Not when Xbox came out, when Xbox 360 came out. I was like, wait, when the Xbox came out, I was like 2001.
Yeah.
So all this time I'm freelancing. So the juices never ended, but my time at Vapors ended maybe 8 months after I started, because someone reached out to me from a motion studio called Buck.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, hey, I saw you work on a blog, and I think, you know, we have this guy leaving, and I think you'd be a good fit. And so, you know, they were paying like...
We interrupt this broadcast of Toys on Tap to bring you this.
Meanwhile, in a galaxy of bootleg treasures.
DOV2, we have engine failure. We must crash land on DKE Toy Planet.
Oh my, we're doomed.
Wait, salvation. Hooray. We're saved, DLP2. Limited edition custom artist-made action figures and DKE toys.
Check out www.dketoys.com for a full catalog.
Hooray for custom action figures.
DKE.
Maybe twice what I was making at the magazine. And that's I had no motion graphics experience. It was one of those things like, well, you know, I don't know how to animate, but I can design. And they do these things called style frames. Mm-hmm. And emotion style frames are like the pitch for the project. Like, what is this going to look like? You know, like, what is the kind of the vibe of the piece? What is the style?
Yeah.
And so I'm basically signed on as like a 2D designer. And so I take the job and I'm like, I'm just going to learn on the job. And that, yeah, working there changed my life. Like, if you look up Buck, like some people may know, but that studio was just a powerhouse. Mm-hmm. It was a powerhouse then. And then now it's just like a global company. They have like offices all over. But that's where I really cut my teeth and really like kind of discovered who, like what my design voice was. Mm-hmm. And I just had an art director, Thomas, who just like, who pushed me, like, you know, like I've never met anyone like that in my life. And I think, you know, if you're fortunate enough to have someone like a mentor like that, mm-hmm. At your work, I mean, you just soak it in like a sponge, you know?
Yeah.
And yeah. The thing about motion graphics is every project is different and the style for every project was different. So I was constantly working in different styles. And I think that kind of forced flexibility, made my work better because I couldn't get comfortable doing one thing.
Yeah.
You know? And so I was just learning new things, new skills all the time, just working collaboratively with my other coworkers, 3D artists, concept artists. Like, it was just like, it was a crazy time. And, you know, I'm like 27, 28 at this time. And it's like perfect.
Yeah.
So
that's like crazy to learn on the job, to have someone that's like pouring into you and you're just like gleaning everything you can.
Yeah.
And then also defining your voice all at the same mm-hmm. time. Like, all these things are just perfect storming.
It is. Yeah. And so I'm freelancing this whole time. And that's also where it kind of leads me to the next part of my career path, is where I kind of burned out. Mm-hmm. You know, I was full time during the day, go home and freelance 5 hours and go to sleep. Mm-hmm. But I was just pushing hard because I was like, I need to build this portfolio. And people, you know, towards the end of my time at Buck were like, how come you just don't go freelance? And I was just scared.
Yeah.
You know, like it didn't matter how much work I had or how many people told me like, oh, you know, you can just do it. It's like, it's to jump in, to kind of leave that safety net was
it's scary.
It's still scary now thinking about it, but I eventually did it because I was like showing up to work late. Like, I'd be the last one in the office. Mm-hmm. Things like that. Like when that schedule starts showing in real life, like the consequences, I knew something had to change. And so I made a decision to finally go freelance. And so I freelanced the motion graphics for a little bit because the studios are pretty tight knit. Mm-hmm. And once they kind of knew my work or where I worked, it's kind of like, oh yeah, do you have, you know, a week to take this booking? And there's so many studios in LA that at that time, it was just easy to just bounce around. Mm-hmm. So I was doing that and still doing freelance print stuff and doing my own artwork. And like, because I did the first decon in 07. Mm-hmm.
Which Pasadena, right?
Pasadena, yeah, in a tiny room.
Yeah.
So there was a lot happening. And it's interesting thinking about it all now because it's like not something I think about daily.
Yeah.
So I would go full-time freelance in 2009 and been freelance ever since. So it's been a long time.
Yeah, that's great. 15 years.
Yeah, 15 years of full-time freelance, not moonlighting on the side.
Yeah. That's crazy. Congratulations, 15 years. of scary behavior. Yeah. You make that jump to freelance. Mm-hmm. And it seems like your life is taking you in just, we're going to keep expanding this portfolio and you're going to learn something new every time. Mm-hmm. When does that move into sculpting or figure design or toys in general?
When I started wanting to pursue things on my own, mm-hmm. like start to finish, were it was 3D based, or sorry, like 3D print based and resin cast.
Yeah.
I wasn't ready to jump into like vinyl manufacturing or manufacturing in general. I was like, what can I do on a small scale that's won't break the bank necessarily? Yeah. Like, it's still an investment, but so I worked with Scott Wetterschneider mm-hmm. On a robot sculpt, and I painted those up and just sold them, like branded them, just like mm-hmm. applied everything that I know how to do into that project. And that's kind of how I approach everything now. It's like, take everything that, you know, I'm proficient in and just try to combine it all.
Yeah.
You know, cause I can make the logo, I can do the type, I can do the illustration. I understand the process of, you know, sculpting and all that stuff. So that was my first foray into it, was getting those robots made. I only did one release of it. Mm-hmm. And then I moved on to the next thing. And this goes back to like my time at Buck. Just, I think my mind became trained on, I don't have the attention span to stick with one thing for a super long time. At least, mm-hmm. at least back then, you know, I was like, do one thing, let me try something else.
Yeah.
And, before long, I learned that it didn't matter that I just kept doing the same thing. It was more that people just started believing in kind of everything I was doing. Like, I didn't have to confine myself to like one character, you know, mm-hmm. like I'm known for this character X and I have to do that forever.
Yeah.
You know, it was just more like, they're just interested in seeing, just my approach, I guess, on whatever it is I wanted to tackle, whatever theme or whatever. So I think that was kind of freeing, you know, and I think only now do I feel that complete kind of freedom where mm-hmm. I'm like, let me just experiment and, you know, hopefully people like it.
You're going to get people emotional listening to this podcast, man. That's crazy.
Yeah. Sorry, went off on a tangent there, but yeah, it's tough, Abe. I feel like, there's just so many things happening at the same time at a lot of these stages in my life that, like, you know, I knew Dove like way back, mm-hmm. you know, I feel like I've known Dove for like, almost 20 years now.
Jeez.
So
yeah. I've known Dove. I mean, it's only been like 3 or 4 years this point.
Right.
Yeah. And one of my favorite people by far. Anyone that
he's the same guy, as he's now as he was then.
Yeah.
Like he's just unchanging and he's just perfect. So he's always been a friend and, you know, his humor is like,
yeah,
if you just get it, you get it.
Yeah. I produced toys with him and I've sold with him and all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's super fun to, I mean, he just questions, like, I made a smaller version of the Fur Berserker and it was like, I sold it through him. And just he has realistic production questions. And he just like, you're going to hate painting this, Abe. Like, you complain about this, you're going to hate painting this. How do we make it easier? And our conversation always goes the same. Like, oh, no, let me like, I got it. Don't worry.
Yeah.
But he's,
you know,
right.
What? I listened to his episode that where you had him on.
Yeah.
And it was just Dove, like basically doing a massive history lesson. I remember because I was listening to it at the dentist mm-hmm. and I was sitting in the chair and I'm like, has Abe talked? Like,
no.
It's just Dove, like he has stories for days, but
yeah,
like, he approaches things practically. And you know how I was like telling you when artists asked me like, hey, I love your toys. I want to make a toy. Where do you get them made? You know, I feel like I follow his school of thought where it's like, you know, slow down, mm-hmm. you know, ask yourself these lists of 100 questions.
Yeah. Yeah. it's such a smart thing to say, slow down. There's been a couple episodes, like I had him on a couple times and I've had, I mean, even having Suckler on the podcast, it's like, sometimes I just get to sit back and like, not talk, which is nice. Like, you just run, just go for it. Yeah. But Dove inspired like things in me just to keep diving and searching and doing things. Mm-hmm. Like, trying to find like the oldest produced resin toys, and like trying to, which has been super fun, and like tracking back the resin toy scene to 1989. I found toys that were produced and like shot out, and that's super early.
Yeah. I feel like that avenue of, I wouldn't even call them designer toys, but just art, mm-hmm. Is just so underground.
Yeah.
And Dove mentions it a lot. It's like the audience that collects what you guys, you know, are passionate about is like such a tiny slice of like the collector world.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I mean,
there's so many amazing things, like so many weird like mm-hmm. things. Like I always like going by Dove's booth at, you know, during DCon or Comic-Con, just because people are submitting crazy things.
Yeah, and we're getting away with it. That's the I think that Toys on Tap started with just going to the resin scene. Mm-hmm. And then it slowly I just started realizing how wide this scene actually is. Like Sifubi and designer and art, and so it just kept spreading and spreading and spreading. And so now I just don't even now I walk through DesignerCon and say hi to most of the people that have been on, because and they're not even in the resin alley area. They're just everywhere, which is nice.
I mean, even your episode list, like you're basically, you want to hear everyone's story.
I do. Yeah, I want to become the archive is what it is. Yeah. So after you've begun, you produce the robots and you move on.
Oh,
and
yeah.
we get kind of in this emotional spot where you're now here in, you have the ability to kind of produce and test and do things that you want to do. And which kind of leads into how I found you. Like before we had like follow each other on Instagram or anything. Like when I was dealing with the Furbzerker and trying to figure stuff out, I was like searching, like, how do you make a paint mask at home? Like, how do you do these types of things? And one of your sculpts came up, and it was like a blog of like all the things that you need or will do with this one toy. And I think it's Tyranitar?
Tyranitar. Yeah. The pterodactyl figure. Yep. Yeah.
And you had said earlier that like gatekeeping still exists, and I get it. I get that people don't want to slow down a factory. To think that a factory will slow down because I need 20 pieces, like, let's have an honest discussion. But
yeah. I don't know if it's about slowdown, but it's more of like, hey, I like your quality. It's kind of like I also want to produce quality. So,
yeah,
you know, it's sharing that kind of like secret sauce. That's the tough part.
And so it's like, I think my goal is to never like point. I just want to point people to wherever they need to go. Honestly, it's whoever wants it. You can go get it. I don't care.
Yeah.
But I found it through there. And then how you explained every aspect of it. Like you moved from sculpt to bring this beautiful piece to life and paint masks and production, all that stuff. And then
production errors.
Yeah.
Problems. Yeah. Yeah.
And then Carl and his arm production error. Like, so I've been like following that side of your work, because that side is so enticing that you're willing to say, this is the behind the scenes. This is the kind of the crappy part sometimes. So tell me about the first moments of, I mean, you can start with either one. Either we talk through Carl or Tyranitar, like which one you want to talk about?
Well, I guess, you know, after I do that robot series and I started experimenting with some wood-based projects. And then, I wanted to turn a rhino beetle design that I had as a embroidered patch into a sculpt, like a resin piece that I would paint and, you know, sell just like everything else.
On the log, and, right?
Yeah, on the log.
Yeah.
And so it was DCon 2018. I had them for sale and Unbox was there. And I've always admired Unbox's work. And I went to talk to Dan. I said, hey, Dan, I got something to show you, you know, like with no expectations. Like, hey, just I was just excited to show him like what I was doing. Because you know, like I love what they're doing. I'm just wanted to share it. So I showed him and he said, he looks at it. He's like, you know, I think we can make this. And I was like, what? You know, this is at DCon.
Yeah.
And then, so he took a chance on me. I mean, he's seen my booth before. you know, he knew who I was already, but it was more, he took a chance on this design and ended up being super popular. And it's been, you know, we've had, I don't know, 13 or 14 releases since. Mm-hmm. And it just keeps going. And, you know, that's one of those things where it's like, it was a self-initiated project that turned into, you know, an opportunity.
Yeah.
And I'm always an advocate for that stuff. It's like, you gotta, I mean, everything we're doing, we're trying to make opportunities for ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You never know who's going to see it. And so, you know, that put me deeper into the vinyl world in a way that I don't think I've been before. Like, mm-hmm. I've always kind of been in the toy scene, but not like where there are people who are waiting for releases and like mm-hmm. variants and drops and things like that. And so, you know, after that point, I was like, you know, maybe it's time I self-fund a designer toy or, you know, a vinyl toy myself. Mm-hmm. And I love dinosaurs. So I was just trying to lean into something I love, something I'd be passionate about and I could stick through that crazy process of making a toy. And so I picked the hardest thing to make a toy of, which is a monster with wings, because wings and Sufubi are, or soft vinyl are just, there's just so many technical issues with wings, just the thinness and the shape. And anyway, I said, forget it, I'm still going to do it. And I sketched something out rough and then felt good about it, got it sculpted, still felt good about it, and then just decided to jump in. And it was a complete gamble. Mm-hmm. It was 100% self-funded. I didn't do a Kickstarter. I just said, I believe in this and I hope someone buys it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
There's a meme
I mean, I,
going
you know,
around.
I was sharing the process. People were excited about the design, asking like, oh, is this going to be vinyl and stuff like that? But
yeah,
that doesn't mean anything. It's kind of like when you show a piece of art and like, do you sell prints? And you're like, yeah, I got prints to my store. And then no one buys the print. You know, that's the joke.
There's a meme going around where it's like the world's on fire. And then someone shouting like, come buy my art.
Yeah, there's that too. But yeah,
that is crazy.
So that was my first. Yeah, that was a chance I took on myself, and I could have failed, and it would have been an expensive lesson. But it turned out better than I thought. I mean, everything sold out, and I'm gonna start doing customs finally on some blanks I had made. Mm-hmm. And you know, my mentality now is like one toy project funds the next.
Yeah,
just because it's just so expensive to make toys.
Yeah.
I mean, I wish I could put four things in production at once, but one, I don't think I have the mental strength to deal with notes on four productions with the factory.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, kind of one big project at a time is manageable.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, collaborating with Unbox and they're, you know, they're releasing things. It's like, it's doable that way. I know plenty of artists do multiple releases throughout the year, like solo, and like, I don't know how you have the time.
Yeah. I mean, Unbox collaborating, that's a dream, like to collaborate with Unbox. I've sent them a message. We've talked a little bit of like, I don't care what it is. It doesn't have to be a toy production. Mm-hmm. I just want to collaborate in some form because I love that brand. But yeah, doing a toy completely self-funded, that's wild because you're taking it from sculpt all the way through factory. I'm assuming your first run, how many did you have printed your first
The Torontor? It was like 900 units because it was I did all the colorways at once, because it was cheaper.
They give you
the math and like, well, if I fire up the molds later, it costs a lot more than shipping and all that. So I was like, you know, I was happy with the colorway that I kind of mocked up in Photoshop. I was like, let's just do them.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So yeah, it was a lot.
Yeah. That's why I think starting small with that like chum figure was super helpful for me. I don't need
size too.
Yeah.
Like Torontor is 8 inches. So it was
massive.
It was a lot of boxes. And smaller figures, much more manageable.
And I think, and you're trying to sell enough to just recoup costs at first. And then it's like, how much can we go above this to fund the next? Yeah. And my goal, I think going into it is like, I just want to get people's work produced. but also like I want to make it as cheap as possible for people. Like I want them to be able to pay the least amount to get it.
Yeah. I remember you mentioning that in another episode. I forgot who you're talking to, but it's like, I love the idea of accessibility,
mm-hmm.
but there's also like, you don't want to underprice the market.
Right.
It's like, you don't want to offer this for $10. I mean, people will buy it, but it's like a perception thing.
Yeah. You
know? So that's kind of a balance that everyone kind of has to figure out for themselves, but yeah, but I'm 100% for the more people who can buy my work and have it in their home, the better. That's why my prints are affordable.
Yeah.
And like everything's affordable, you know, and I'm sure I could charge more, but you know, it's like a quantity thing for me. Like the more I can just, share, the better.
Tell me, so after you've done that and it seems like you're still producing it a little bit because you have blanks and stuff.
Oh, blanks. Yeah. They're already made. Okay, I just haven't painted them. They've just been in the garage and I just need to do that.
Because with the robot, like we made it, we moved on from it. Is this one of those toys that like you're going to now produce and then it's like, okay, we're moving to the next project, or will you come back to this one?
There is another. So Toronto was under the banner of something I made up called Primeval Island.
Mm-hmm.
And before it was going to be like Toronto and like other kind of dinosaur characters that follow the same style,
mm-hmm.
kind of exist in this, you know, Skull Island type place.
Yeah.
I'm calling it Primeval Island. But, you know, as a few years went by, I realized like, you know, I fell back on the idea of I can just experiment with something else that's dinosaur related,
mm-hmm.
but a different style, but still have it under that banner or that name.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, after I kind of freed myself from the constraints of like, everything has to look like Tarantor, like, you know, he's the foundation, everything has to build from that.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like anything dinosaur related now will be under Primeval Island.
Yeah.
So I have some new dinosaur sculpts in the works that are, there's three of them. One's done, but there are two more that are being worked on right now by my friend Brandon. And I'm excited about those. And they look nothing like Tarantor.
Awesome.
So yeah, it's going to be weird. It's going to be goofy. And I think I just need that kind of energy right now.
Yeah. Tell me about Carl, because that piece as a whole pivots from, we've done the rhino beetle, we've mm-hmm. done dinosaurs, and then you moved to Carl.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about Carl.
I've always liked the Kappa character, just from mm-hmm. Japanese lore and just how it's represented. And, you know, everyone's interpretations of the Kappa is different. Mm-hmm. I mean, traditionally it's a pretty vile character, but there's so many cute versions of mm-hmm. a Kappa that I felt like I wanted to do my version of a Kappa to kind of contribute to that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so many soft vinyl makers that do such amazing versions of, you know, of that, you know, or drawing inspiration from that lore. But, so I just decided to do it and, sketched some stuff out, tweaked it, got it sculpted. And I was like, yeah, this is it. And, then I started building a brand around it, and I haven't shared a lot of the merch I've been, building around it, but I've been kind of approaching it like Sanrio.
Mm-hmm.
And when Carl is released, there will be this big, I have this big rollout planned.
Nice. Can't wait.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
and then
yeah,
you got just Metal Carl, which is
Metal
also.
Metal Carl, yeah.
I can't wait. Like when someone takes a character and then does the other character, but like metal, one of my favorite things, because it's such a fun, like, we're just going to move the other way, but still Carl.
Yeah. And I was doing my research. I was like, has anyone done a Mecha Kappa yet?
Mm.
And I couldn't find one that was 100% like Mecha.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, huh. So, so my idea was that Carl was kind of a tinkerer and he just mm-hmm. built Metal Carl in his image.
Yeah.
And, kind of like Urkelbot and Steve Urkel.
Oh yeah.
he's not like a Terminator or anything. But yeah, it was just a weird idea I had, and the design worked, and I was like, yeah, this is strange and cute, and it kind of works in this world. So, yeah.
That's rad. That's so rad. tell me about some upcoming projects. I mean, you have the two dinosaurs that are coming. We got some Carl stuff working.
Yep.
That's a lot of projects.
There's more Carl stuff working in the works too.
Okay.
There's some unexpected avenues for Carl.
Yeah.
I can't share those yet, but I'm staring at it, but I can't share it yet.
Yeah.
I have a Ninja Turtles release with Unbox.
Awesome.
I think that's probably going to come out maybe early spring.
Okay.
It's being produced right now. That was also a dream come true to kind of go back to my roots and contribute to the brand in that way.
Yeah.
And, you know, that opportunity wouldn't have happened had I not had this relationship with Unbox. So it's like everything, you know, everything's connected. Other than that, I am doing, well, related to Carl, I haven't really shared this anywhere, but I'm doing a series of 3D printed fictional fishing lures. So Carl likes fishing.
Okay.
So I'm basically making lures that he would use and then sizing them up to like human scale, obviously.
Yeah.
Not figure scale. And, you know, they're just going to be, they're super fun and abstract and kind of wonky, and they just match his world. It's like, what do fishing lures in Carl's world look like?
Yeah.
And so those are going to be offered as like 3D printed sculptures that they're going to come on a black walnut base with like a brass rod. So it'll be really easy to present. So yeah, excited to unveil that. I'm going to start printing those with my friend later this week. So the sculpts are done. And so, yeah.
Excited. Yeah. Those sound awesome. That's such a fun way to like build out a world without having to build out the world.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just like, you know, I love fishing. I love fishing growing up. Mm-hmm. I don't fish anymore here because LA is not a fishing city.
Yeah.
So I'm just leaning into like my childhood in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like, I'm going to draw He-Man, you know, for a long time it was that. And then now it's like, just drawing from feelings and moments and like, I don't know, deeper things. I don't know, as you get older, it's like, that's why I like pop culture. And I was mentioning earlier, just kind of burned me out.
Mm-hmm.
Just how much there is now. And just, so I'm just trying to find other ways to get inspired by nostalgia.
Yeah. With DesignerCon coming up, when this releases, it will be after DesignerCon. So we just got back. But not having a booth this year, what's that feeling like going as just a person?
It makes me sad because, you know, there are very few people in that room that will have been there since 07,
mm-hmm.
which was like me and like five other vendors.
Yeah.
So to have skipped this year, it's like, you know, things change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, since we're in the future now, hopefully attendance was good.
Yeah.
Vendor turnout looks awesome.
Yeah.
You know, I'm so excited to be a fan. Like there's some visiting artists that I want to get toys signed, like Chino Lam and people who never come to the States.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I'm excited to not have to work, but I'm also, it's a little bittersweet just because, you know, people look for me there and people DM me like, oh, you're going to be in Vegas? I'm like, no, not this year, but I'll be there. But I will have a toy signing though at Unbox.
Or awesome.
I did have one since we're in the future.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah.
What's the
I hope toy... it happened actually. Yeah.
What's the toy that you're signing?
It is a decon edition of another Rhino Beetle.
Heck yeah, it is. Yeah. Awesome.
It's a pretty cool one. I'm doing something with it that hasn't been done yet.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really excited about this colorway. So I don't know when it is. I think Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's amazing. That's super cool. It's crazy to think that all of this kind of started out of nowhere with someone saying like, hey, those are cool figure, like cool pictures. Like I want to produce those all the
my
way.
My toy
back.
Journey. Yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, really it started from a magazine.
Yeah.
You know, that I found out of Borders.
Yeah. Which is so crazy to think about for, even the next grouping of artists. I mean, it seems like it's gonna continually get harder to get in to doing art or doing art full time. And so it's
harder, but it's also more accessible because of all the tools we have now. Like 3D printing is like set it and forget it now. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just that just wasn't around back then. It was impossible.
Yeah. So I remember when it came out and they had like the first 3D printers you can get were like thousands of dollars.
Oh yeah.
And you were like, that's awesome. I'm never going to get that. And now they're like a couple $100. You're like, I might get 3 of them. Like, let's see how this works.
That's how I felt about like flat screen TVs. Like when those first came out, I was like, someday, I think I saw one when I was like 19. I was like, someday I'm going to own one of these.
Yeah.
You know, now they're like, whatever. Like,
you can't get the other ones now. Yeah.
Yeah. They're free. You know, they're giving away TVs, but maybe we'll get to that point with 3D printers. But I feel like the tools at every artist's disposal now, I mean, one, there's too many, probably too many options. But it's there. If you know, need to get something done or made, there's options to do it without, like, do it yourself. I mean, you know,
right.
Laser cutters, 3D printers, I mean, all kinds of stuff. So,
which is so crazy. And I love every bit of it.
Yeah. Me too. I want it all. I want all the equipment, but I don't have space for it.
Yeah. Oh, geez. Yeah. Chris, it's been awesome having you on the podcast. It means the world. The last part of the podcast is plugging all the stuff you've got coming up that people can get, where they can get it from, any collabs, how they get in contact, all that stuff. And then we have an episode of the Nitty Gritty that we get to talk through something artist specific that goes on the Patreon for another 10 minutes. Yeah. So I do have something very specific for you for artists to do that. But please do all the stuff you got to do. Plug your stuff.
Well, if you went to DCon, hopefully you picked up my Rhino Beetle release. Hopefully you arrived on time.
There we go.
And if you did, thank you. Look forward to Carl early next year. I mean, gosh, I plan to have this thing for Tag Fest.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, that's so sick.
I mean, I started this almost a year ago. So that's how long the stuff takes sometimes. So Carl's coming, and a lot more related to Carl's coming. The new dinosaurs I have for my Primeval Island line. And I think that's, the Ninja Turtles from Unbox. And I think that's about it right now.
Awesome. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Dude, thank you so much again for coming on Toys on Tap.
Thanks, Abe.